Hi, good afternoon. My name is Olaf Hubel. I'm on the Office 365 team working in Redmond. And I'm here. You guys want to quickly introduce yourself?
Oh, we'll do that.
Oh, you do it later? Okay. I'm just going to be here for a quick minute explaining why those guys were building what they built. So I'm running the SharePoint conference, and I asked them to set this site up and what I wanted to get out of that site, so the SharePointConference.com website. I think, and they will tell you during this session, I was one of the most difficult customers possible, because I wanted to do everything out of the box. It all had to be running on SharePoint using out-of-the-box SharePoint stuff, yet I wanted everything customized just for me, just in this special little way. And so I'm really proud to say I believe it worked. I'm super, super happy with this website. So the session today is going to be all about, like, you know, how did we build the site, how did they thought about building the site, how we're hosting it, and all the beautiful stuff there. So that's from the building the site, and then we'll talk about the analytics of the website as well, which is one of my pet projects. Is all been about data and everything that we've been doing about data collection, about the whole conference as a whole, actually. And so Web Trends have played a really big role in there in giving me the insights that I needed on this website. And so during this session, they're going to talk about what they've done for this website and how we made that happen as well. So I'll leave it to that, so I won't bore anybody with too much of what I wanted, and we'll go straight into the real content.
All right.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Olaf.
Thanks, Olaf.
All right. First, to get things clear, what we're talking about in this session, let me switch to the sites we're talking about. We're talking about SharePointConference.com, not my SPC. And we're talking about, remember this, the announcement site? I'll let it, just let it running for a minute, because I really love this page. So these are the two things we're going to talk about in this session, how we build them, and nothing about my SPC, but this is it. Did you all see this? Great. It's almost there. Just pay attention to the Las Vegas sign turning on.
Woo!
And we're there. All
and
right.
Here we are.
All right. Before we start, let's do a quick introduction of ourselves. My name is Robert Franson. I'm a business development manager with Wortel, a company based off the Netherlands, and a Microsoft partner for many years.
And hi, I'm Jeff Sechrist. I run product strategy for Web Trends. We are a Microsoft partner. Microsoft is one of our clients, which is why I'm here. Olaf, as a client, was looking for analytics on SharePointConference.com, and so I connected with Robert and his team to talk about what the requirements were and build out an analytics solution for that site. So I'm happy to be here today to talk to you about that. I'm based in Portland, Oregon. We have a booth on the exhibit floor. I think you do as well, yes?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. but we do. And so come by and check out the Web Trends booth if you're able.
All right. Let's move to the things we're going to talk about this afternoon. We're going to let you see how we host this site on Azure and what we did to make that happen. After that, we're going to share our experiences with all the things we ran into when we built the site, the things that were possible, the things that were not possible. After that, I will do a quick demo of some of the things I will be talking about.
Yeah, and then we're going to talk about the analytics. So we built the analytics in at the start, but we're going to talk about how that was done. And talk a little bit about some of the insights that Olaf and his team were able to yield. Before we get started, how many of you in the crowd have used SharePoint to build externally facing sites? Wow, good.
Quite a bit.
Yeah, good cross selection. Mm-hmm. And so, how anyone in progress with some new projects? All right, good. Well, hopefully you'll learn some things here today about how Robert and his team tackled that challenge and got a great, effective website up and running. So, why don't you take it away, Robert?
I will. So first, we're going to talk about Azure, Azure Virtual Machines. We use to host the SharePoint conference website. Have any of you been to the session before lunch about deploying internet-facing websites on Azure? None? All right, great. Because then you'll have a quick recap of what was said there as well. How many of you know Azure Virtual Machines? All right, quite a bit. Still not. So I'll quickly get you through the cloud hosting model, the cloud model that Microsoft always uses when they're talking about moving to the cloud. We start off with on-premise. You got all these layers of infrastructure and applications that you have to manage yourself. The next thing when you move to the cloud is the first step is infrastructure as a service, where Microsoft actually is the company doing all the networking, the physical machine hosting, and the virtualization layer, and everything up from there is managed by yourself. Platform as a service, where you only build your applications and deploy them to Azure to have Azure run those applications. And last but certainly not least, software as a service, which we all know is Office 365. When we're talking about Azure Virtual Machine, we're talking about infrastructure as a service. All right. Why would you host your public-facing website on Azure? First of all, it's the cost model that Azure brings along. It's just you pay for what you use, you pay for the machines that are running, for the storage that you use, and nothing else. You can turn on and turn off machines as you like. You start paying when you turn them on, and you stop paying when you turn them off. So it's extremely flexible for scaling up, scaling down your environment as you go along. So when you have a lot of traffic coming in the holiday season, you can just put in some extra machines. And when everybody bought their presents for the holidays, then you just switch them off and you stop paying for them. You can provision your service based on templates. It's actually like SharePoint. When you create a site, you can choose a template. You can actually create your own templates as well, your virtual machine templates. So you can have a pre-configured SharePoint front-end server, for instance. And you can create a new server based on that template real quick. It can be up and running 10 to 15 minutes, and you're good. But why still use this instead of Office 365? Well, as you probably all know, the public-facing website capabilities of Office 365 are pretty limited. You cannot create an enterprise-ready website there, so you still need the on-premise version of SharePoint, but you can host it in the cloud, so you can still get rid of the data center that's sitting in your office. When we look at the architecture of the SPC website, what we did was actually create two identical farms. In this case, farm one is the production farm. That's the farm that visitors are routed to. And we have production farm two. It's still production, but we use it internally as the development farm. So when we create a new version of the site, we will be working on the production farm two, and visitors are routed to production farm one. So you see, in production farm two, we don't need as much front-end service because there's no load on there. Redundancy is not that important, so we can switch off one of the application servers and one of the SQL servers on that farm, so we save cost. The only thing you pay for is the storage that your virtual machines take up, but that's all. In a global manner, so serving both farms is an Active Directory and a System Center Operations Manager gateway. I don't know if you're all familiar with SCOM, but that's a system that does the monitoring of your entire network and machines. At Wartell, we have our own Active Directory and the main service center environment that collects all the analytics that SCOM does for us on this production farm. And there's just a simple to set up VPN in between. It's actually pretty straightforward and standard to create. We got the gateway, the SCOM gateway in Azure and the Active Directory in Azure because VPNs tend to fail sometimes, and you still want your users to be able to log on to the website even when the VPN is down. And you'd still want SCOM to collect all the data from the servers even when the VPN is down, and when the VPN is up, it just pushes through all the data. All right. Like I said, there's one farm is running production and is available for the visitors. The other one is not. When we're done developing, we need to deploy the website. So we actually use the capabilities of Azure to do that. First off, you start with developing a new version on the, in our case, production farm 2. All the time you need, you can do all the testing. Relax there, because nobody's routed to there. The only thing is that your testers need to put the IP address in their host file to be able to actually get to that version. And when everything is tested and accepted, it's time to deploy or switch, actually, to the new farm. So the first thing you do is you synchronize all the content that was done in the production farm over to the development farm. And depending on how much changes that were made in between the last version, the last switch you did, you can just easily copy over some of the pages and images, because on internet-facing websites, the content doesn't change that often. So if that's the case, that's the quickest way to do it, just copy it over. You can also do a backup restore of the content database to get there. So when the content is synchronized, first thing you do is scale up the development farm, because we shut down a lot of servers there. And before you want your visitors to actually hit that farm, you need to scale it up, just boot the machines, boot the front-end servers, the SQL server and the application server, so it's able to take on the load of the visitors that are about to arrive there, and then actually reroute the visitors to the development farm. And that's a pretty easy way. Just change your DNS entry. Before you do that, make sure your TTL is set to very short, because otherwise it can take 3 days for the whole world to know about that change. But set it to 15 minutes, change it, and from that moment on, actually, your production farm 2 is serving your visitors, and production farm 1 can be shut down. You can shut down the extra machines there to save cost again. Clean up after you're done. Maybe you need to get some artifacts or whatever over. Take your time, because no one's there. It's wise to wait with that for a couple of days, because you still have this as a rollback mechanism. When anything goes wrong, you can still switch DNS back. It's that easy. This model is called the rolling release model, or something that's similar to that. So it's pretty easy to use this way of content deployment. There are several other ways of deploying new versions of websites. You can use the publishing model of SharePoint itself. You can do backup restore of content databases. But we wanted to try this out because it really showed off how Azure is helping us creating this site. All right, enough about Azure. This session was called from sketch to eventually live. So let's talk about the sketch phase of this project and what we learned from that in collaboration with the entire team to get the best experience up. So this is actually mostly about the announcement page we created. That was the hardest part in designers and developers working together. Well, this is actually a pretty complicated project geographically wise, because this was, on one point in the project, this was actually the geographical spread of people had to work together on this site. So there were developers in Auckland, there was a project manager in Dubai, we were based in Amsterdam, the project the technical lead of the event management system is based in Chicago, and Microsoft, of course, is based in Seattle. And I'm allowed to put Portland near Seattle. And so this is what the geographical spread, and that made it pretty complicated to to work together. When we first got involved in this project, that was about April or May last year, this was the first design we were given. You can see some things going on there, but that was the first thing we saw. And we started talking to the design team that had no technical knowledge whatsoever to build it into a website. So they start working on this and explaining what they were trying to achieve. So this was actually the first, more or less, design we start working with. Still not finished, not the final result. But in a classic web development project, you, as a developer, you still have to wait until the designers are done, have everything in Photoshop done, and transfer it over to the developers and say, good luck with that. I'll check on your site when it's done. But actually, we didn't. We didn't wait. This is the first design we actually started developing with. So we were going to set up a framework for all the animations. But the idea in this point was still to have an interactive site. So to ask a question to the visitor that had to give the right answer and then move on to the next transition in the next building that would fall down from the sky. So we were working on that in the early stage, and the designers took a look at that and said, well, that's not working. That's not going to work. When we sketched it out, it sounded all great, the interactive things, but users are not going to do that. They're probably going to turn from the site and leave it at that. So we changed the idea entirely to have the animations flow through like a movie and just do everything automatically. If we didn't show them the early sketches of our development work, they would probably just have seen the first version when we were done with development. So probably spend the budget and then some. Because, well, most projects don't need the budget entirely. So when you wait until the full delivery, you get a problem with your budget and you get a problem with your timing, because the date that this site had to go live was pretty strict. Not a day early, not a day late. Because the announcement had to be specifically on that day. So that actually resulted in the page I just showed you. And we're pretty proud of what we did. In a short time, it's about 3 weeks to a month that we spent on this in total, from the sketch to actually the working site go live. And it's pretty fast for a project like this. All right, so what we learned from this was that designers, developers really need to collaborate. Do not do your work in your own silo and then hand it over to the next team, but they really have to interact and involve the developers from day one. I don't know if there are designers in this room, but please do. They're nerds, they're geeks, I know, but they really can help to make your designs better and to make sure that they're capable of running on the day you need to go live. Create mutual awareness. So do not just tell what the problem is, why you can't build it, but show it. Do not tell what the site is supposed to look like, but explain why, explain how you got to that design. So the developer can actually give you good input in that phase. And share all the incrementals. That's actually the most important thing. As early as possible, share what you got, share what you have done so far. The first development versions we showed, the designer still had debug code in it and timers on the screen showing what everything was doing. Normally not what you show to a designer because it was not very pretty. But we did anyway. And that's how we learned the best way this could work. And communicate. As you saw, we had we had an entire project team scattered around the world. So we used email, of course. We had a SharePoint website, and of course, Jammer. We used Jammer a lot, and we started using it more and more throughout the project. So it really, you were able to share everything you did without the other one needed to be online. We had a lot of conference calls as well. That meant that we in Holland had to work at night. It's better to make sure that you have a persistent way of communicate, and Jammer is great for that. All right, then let's move to the SharePoint features. And I'm going to highlight some of the SharePoint features we used to really meet the objectives that the content editors didn't care this was SharePoint, because they were supposed to edit the content. Microsoft is produced SharePoint, but it's also an end user. And there are still people there needing to get content as easy as possible. So there was an interesting project in that way. Something that was hard to do in 2010 was to create a different layout for an author and for the visitor. In a lot of cases, you really it's better to get them apart and give the authors a different view on the website, because the authors just need to be productive. They need to get content into the system and not fiddle around with layout at that point. So what we did to make this possible was still a standard SharePoint, right? Remember what Olaf said? We were only allowed to use out-of-the-box SharePoint features. No custom coding. So we created a device channel for authors. This device channel served the visitor that was presented with that device channel just the Seattle master. That's it. It's there. It's in the product. It's tested. It works. We didn't need to get them a separate layout. I will show you how that works a little bit later. You can have it triggered by a cookie. That's the easiest way, actually, to do that. Device channels can be triggered by a cookie. You can, of course, trigger it by the device or by the browser type, but also by a cookie setting. And that's the easiest way. You can just create a page that sets a cookie for that visitor, and that means that that browser from that point on is presented with that device channel. And that means that when they go to the site in that browser, they get presented the Seattle master. They get a normal login button, so they don't have to browse to /settings.aspx, which is hard to explain to a content editor, to get it authenticated. And they can still check the layout in other browsers or to go in private in that browser to get the publishing layout. So this way, we can get rid of all the things we don't need for publishing the site and rendering the site in the right way in our publishing layout. Just get rid of all the controls that are needed to edit content, a ribbon, or for notifications that SharePoint does. SharePoint, for instance, when SharePoint is detecting that the SQL Server is offline or in read-only mode, it will present the user a message, sorry for your inconvenience, but we're in read-only mode, which is irrelevant for an anonymous visitor on the website. Get a control that renders that out, and you will never bother them with that. So you can really control the HTML output of your website. And it's a lot easier to develop and to test with that, because it's just not in the way. And especially when you want to try and build a responsive website, what we did, it renders well, I hope, on all devices and all browsers. And when all the controls of editing are in there, that means a lot of extra testing and a lot of extra things to do. And you have to instruct your content masters. What we saw is throughout the project, a lot of content editors were added to the site but not instructed well. And we got a lot of questions about that. So make sure that all the content masters are instructed to go to the cookie page and how to use that. It's a simple thing to instruct, but you need to do that because otherwise, in our case, you get a lot of questions at 10 p.m. And I'd rather do different things at that time. All right. One of the things we really needed to get into the site is cross-site publishing. I don't know if you remember the launch of 2013. It's one of the great things in WCM projects, or in WCM capabilities of SharePoint, is the ability to use cross-site publishing. So what is it? What is cross-site publishing? It means that we have an authoring site somewhere that's not publicly accessible in our case. And users can put content into that site, into lists, and we can publish the list as a catalog. I will show you that in a demo a little bit later on. What then happens is search is going to crawl that. We'll recognize that it's actually a catalog and store it as such in the index. Make sure when you create the catalog on the left-hand side in this case, you enable anonymous access, because otherwise it'd still be security trimmed and not available on the for anonymous users. And that publishes it out throughout the publishing site. So the publishing site can grab it from the index and get it into the site and have the master page render it. This is actually a bit of a weird schema, this, because why do this? I mean, when we started out, we were planning on building several sites. We call them microsites. That was the initial plan. They were taken out later on. But there were supposed to be a couple of sites on the right-hand side here. And then you can really benefit from this cross-site publishing model, because you have to author it only once and get all the content available on all the publishing sites. So we still did this. And actually, why we used it is because we could. That was a great thing for us. We were actually building a site on SharePoint, and we were allowed to do whatever it took to get all the great features in there. So we finally got to do something just because we could. So what are catalogs good for? They're actually, especially so besides the cross-site publishing, they're good for very long lists. So when you have a list with a lot of items that you need to publish out individually to your website, catalogs are actually a great way of doing that. Because the alternatives are, you either create a lot of pages. In our case, sessions, 278 sessions on this conference. You don't want to create 278 pages and maintain them. The other alternative is to create a custom ASPX that actually gets, for instance, a session code from the URL, from a query string, and retrieves the data from SharePoint and publishes out. But that's custom code. We're not allowed to do that, and we don't want to do that, because we want, for instance, clean URLs. So this is actually what using a catalog does for you, is just have one ASPX file and creating the clean URL with that. So using cross-site publishing, what do you need to do that? Is first you set up the catalog. You enable it on the source list. It's just in list settings. You can configure it as a catalog from there. Remember to make it enable it for anonymous access. And you go to the consuming site. There's in the site settings a link called Manage Catalog Collections Connections, and it's just automatically there. Wait for the crawl to go over that once, but it appears there automatically. You don't have to do anything. It's good for structured content. So anything that goes in a list, you can enable it on pages as well, but what's the point? You can do that to make the content editing experience a little bit easier, but that's not a real point for doing that. And in our case, we used it for the sliders. You got on several pages. You got these sliding banners. They were authored in a catalog. The sponsors were in there. And of course, sessions and speakers were published out as catalogs. One thing to keep in mind when you use catalogs on a cross-site publishing environment is mind the assets. Because in our case, for instance, the banners, they were put in on the authoring farm that was in total not anonymously accessible. So when you store your assets there, the crawl will find the asset, but only crawl and store the metadata in the index, not the image, for instance, itself. So the URL gets published out to the publishing site, but not the image itself. So users will always get a access denied on their page there. So what you do there is to make sure that the pictures in your site are uploaded to a SharePoint site that is anonymously accessible. In our case, we just use the publishing site itself. And help your content editors by setting suggested browsing locations to make sure that then when they upload an image or add an image or choose an image, that they're directed to the right location automatically. All right. Let's take a look at some of the pages we created. You probably recognize this. This is the session overview page, and what we did over here. Does anybody recognize this speaker? Yeah? There was a slight problem with him this morning, right? I found out later. I already had him in this session. All right, what we did actually here is just have the normal search experience with the normal search result web part, and we just started working on the out-of-the-box, with the out-of-the-box display templates. We copied them over first, of course, because you cannot edit the out-of-the-box themselves. We copied them over, and we start editing them until the callout was right until the search results itself were right, but we did nothing but use the standard functionality here, and the callout is there by default. So we didn't have to program in the on Hoover flyout thing. It was there. Cost us a lot of time to get it to look like this, but one thing we learned here is that when you use filtering refiners on your page, there's actually not just one simple button that clears all the selections you made. That's actually something we missed. So we just had a hard-coded link in there that redirects you to the overview page itself, which is actually the same as reset all filters. It's a sneaky trick, but it worked. One other thing that we found out, and we actually looked, is there's a way to modify the results and the ordering of the results by using query rules, but query rules don't fire on this page. Query rules really need a query. So in the URL, that's something like k is whatever should be there, and there's not. Even when you click on a filter, still the query rules don't fire. So we could not use query rules to adjust the ranking, what we still wanted to do. So we chose to adjust the X rank. You can give specific items extra bonus points so they can get up in the results. And another thing we had is that refiners only appear when they're a part of the results set in the result web part that doesn't load all the results by default that are good for that query. So what we found out is that some of the tracks in this case were not showing up on the page. So we had to play around a little bit with the size of the result set and the number of items that were displayed on the page to make sure that all the things were there. Then the session page itself, it's just one ASPX file for all the items. The content is edited outside of SharePoint. This content is actually managed in the event management system that was used for this event. So all the content was put in there, published out, and imported into SharePoint. Why did we import it into SharePoint and not use a BCS connection? BCS creates an external list. And unfortunately, external lists cannot be published out as catalogs. So we couldn't use BCS to publish out this content to the website. So we actually wrote a job that imported all the data and put it into a SharePoint list and published it out from there because we can publish that as a catalog. And we used a job to do that to reduce the load on the backend system. So I said no custom code. We were allowed to use a little bit of custom code for that. Actually, the guy who wrote it is in the back, checking out his code, I think, right? The rest of the content of the site is just regular pages that are published on the publishing site itself. Not too hard. Why bother? It's the mechanism that works and is in place. So we used old-fashioned pages. New page and get it in their page layouts still work. They're still good for more or less static pages. And our menu is controlled by managed navigation, of course, so we could actually get the structure of our navigation completely detached from the actual storage of the pages, because all the pages are stored in one page library. Just in the root of the site, all the pages are there, and we structure them in the managed navigation settings. So to wrap it up, one ASPX file to display all the content. Make sure you consider the URL format. You can set that in the catalog settings, the way the URL looks. Make sure it's a unique value. The title would probably have been unique, but would create very long URLs for the sessions, so we use the session code. And external lists cannot be configured as a catalog. All right. Let's take a look a bit at what we did here. So this is the keynote. We've all been there, right? Let's check if the connection is still there. It is. This is the way this page looks to a normal user. And when we take a look at how a content editor sees this page, we can just, I will fake it a little bit right now to get a cookie in this browser session. And when I just click this away and reload the page right now, thinks there is a cookie set. All right? So this actually pretends that the cookie is set in a normal cookie, but I did it in, so when I close my browser, this is gone. But just for demo purposes, this is what the content managers see. This is how they see the page. Well, it's pretty recognizable, right? This is what SharePoint looks like. This is what they're used to. Just by setting a cookie in the same browser, we get a different experience on this page. So that's about the cookie setting. It's that simple. All right, let's go to the catalog. As you can see from the URL, I don't know if it's visible from behind, but this is the authoring site that's not publicly accessible, but this is where some of the catalogs are managed. Frequently asked questions, sponsors, and sliders. And we're just looking at the sponsor list right now. We had an adjusted view just to make it easier for the content managers. And they can just add a new sponsor to this list by creating a new item over here, give the sponsor a name, what type of sponsor it is, what sort order it should be presented in, because some of the categories have multiple sponsors. And they can upload a picture from here. And when they browse, you can actually see from here that is set to another URL. So the suggested browser locations we set. It's just available in the site settings. Make sure that automatically the user gets redirected to the right site and doesn't make a mistake while authoring this. I will not save everything because actually this is the live site we're looking at. So I'm demoing on the live site. I have a colleague there that is going to be nervous when I break something. I'll try not to. So this is how the catalogs work. And when we take a look at the homepage, these are just published on the homepage using a out-of-the-box content search web part that is configured to get data from that catalog and publish it out here. All right. Then when we go to the site itself, because the catalog for speakers and sessions we just put in the publishing site itself, no need for cross-site publishing there. So they're all imported in a list. I see there are a couple of sessions added, four, because the last time I looked there were a little bit less. But it's just a regular list that is, like I said, imported from the backend system and put in here and just stored in a regular list. And when we look at these list settings, you can see that from here you can set the catalog sessions settings. Is it okay? Is it viewable? Can everybody see? There's just a checkbox. Check it, save it, and it's a catalog. When you do that and you want it available for anonymous viewers, make sure that this button is on. Set the unique value here from the session code, and that's it. Now it's published as a catalog and can be picked up from a search web part to publish out. All right, let's see. So that's using the catalogs. I wanted to show you one more thing about manipulating the sort orders, because like I said, on the default page, we could not use query rules, but we did use some query rules underwater. So let me go to this page. This is the session overview page. And when we go search for a session, let's say best SVC session, and run this query to see what the best session of the conference is, it gives us a bunch of results. Let's see. I'm just missing one session in here, actually. That's weird. That must be a bug. So we have to fix that one, because I'm missing, of course, this session. So when we go to the site settings, and we go to the query rules for the site collection, we just go to the right result source. Let's see that. Then you can see there are a bunch of query rules that we created for this site. And now we're going to just create one more. And actually, this is the live site. So just you can check afterwards if it's working. Best session. Best SBC session. So now we're going to create a query rule that fires when a user searches for best SBC session, these specific words. And we can add a promoted result. And a promoted result was something that used to be best bets in SharePoint. Give it a title. Give it a URL. So this URL should be presented. Save it. Save it from here, and then we go back to the search. Let's see if it's really fast this time. And it's there, instant. So now our session is on top, and make sure that everybody visits it on the website when they look for best SBC sessions. Should I leave this? Yeah. I should, right? All right. This concludes my my demo, so I'm going to hand it over to Jeff.
Thanks, Robert. I asked earlier how many of you had built a externally facing site on SharePoint, but I neglected to ask how many of you were measuring that site. See a show of hands? Okay, good. But regardless of whether you have published an externally facing site or whether you're using SharePoint mostly for internal sites, how many of you would say you have a measurement framework in place in your organization? Okay, just a couple. Well, that's what we're here to talk about today, is building a measurement framework for your SharePoint solutions. I have a few copies of a book that we wrote. It's called Prove It, Using Analytics to Drive SharePoint Adoption and ROI. If you ask a question later in the session, you'll get a book. Or if you stop by the Web Trends booth and tell them Jeff sent you, you can get one that way too. But we're going to encourage questions here before we're done. So the reason I ask about measuring SharePoint is that often when we talk to people, they have initiatives in place that they've had in place for any number of years and really haven't done any sort of measurement. And so when we talk to them, you know, they say, well, when's the right time to think about measurement? And the right time to think about measurement is at the beginning. It's as you're developing the site. Because when you're developing a site, if you're thinking about the users that you have for the site, you're thinking about the outcomes that you're trying to deliver on, you need to understand those things and be able to build a site that delivers the end users to those outcomes. And if you're not measuring it, you don't really know if you're meeting that success. And so this quote here is often attributed to Peter Drucker, but it actually goes further back than that to Lord Kelvin. If you cannot measure it, you cannot improve it. And so, you know, it's kind of one of these things like if you are able to measure certain things that matter on your SharePoint site, you can then work to improve the results that you are delivering. So how do you think about that? As I said, measurement's not an afterthought. And I was talking to a few people in our booth earlier this week, and one of the comments that I got was, why does this matter? You know, we were looking at some of the metrics, and he said, well, what does it matter if that's good or bad? I said, well, maybe that doesn't matter if it's good or bad for you, because I don't know what your business objectives are. The way when you think about in putting a measurement framework in place is not just creating a bunch of reports just because you can. It's thinking about what are you trying to accomplish and then linking those corporate goals to some specific business objectives and then determining what are the measures of success that will tell me if I'm delivering on those objectives. And then you can think about the tactics that you're running and improving those different tactics as well. So let's turn our attention to the SharePointConference.com website. When we were working with Olaf early on, what he said is, you know, we're trying to build engagement and attendance. The website exists to get people to the conference. And so we started thinking about, okay, what are the metrics there? Well, clearly registrations is the number one metric around whether or not this site is successful in getting people to this site. So we looked at conversions, and we tied conversions to a whole range of things, including marketing campaigns that were being run and other ways people were getting to the site. And we also looked at the conversion funnel. And I'll talk about that as well, because that presented an interesting challenge in that the actual registration process was not happening on the SharePoint-run SharePointConference.com website. It was running on the MySPC part of the website, which was then turned on and exposed to all of you as the conference got closer. So we had to think about that cross-domain tracking to really understand how people were moving from the site through to the registration process. So the business value, obviously, they want higher attendance. You know, getting registrations reduces the cost of the event for Microsoft, and they want a greater marketing reach. We also talked about optimizing their marketing spend. So like most organizations, Microsoft, you know, spent a fair amount of time and money thinking about how to get customers to the SharePoint Conference website. So they had a range of marketing campaigns and programs that they were running, from banner ads to emails to blog posts postings on other Microsoft-owned properties that directed people to the site. And they wanted to understand which of those was driving the greatest conversions. So not just the most traffic, but which ones were driving people to actually register for the event. So we took a look at that as well. Microsoft wants to expand the use of SharePoint. They want to expose all of you who are at the conference here to some cutting-edge ways that SharePoint is being used to build leading-edge websites. And so we've seen a lot of sessions like that here where customers and clients of Microsoft are presenting their websites and the things that they've built in SharePoint. And so that's part of what Microsoft wanted to do, but they wanted to look at what the visitors to the site were interested in. Are they looking at, which sessions were they looking at? Which speakers were getting the most interest? And they use that not only to help them to understand how to handle the event logistically in terms of, you know, which rooms they want to make sure have adequate capacity, but also to understand, you know, what people are interested in for future events as well. So to do a lot of this, they used Web Trends. As I mentioned, Microsoft is a Web Trends client, as well as Web Trends being a Microsoft partner. So this is my one sort of promotional slide. But we're a Microsoft partner in Gold partner in content and collaboration. And we worked closely with Microsoft to develop an analytics solution for SharePoint. It's a Microsoft preferred analytics solution and is used by Microsoft, including the Office team. So we built this to have really quick implementation, quick time to value, and to deliver across any type of SharePoint initiative, whether it's a SharePoint on-premises, Office 365, intranet, extranet, or SharePoint for internet sites. And so, and I mentioned the intranets because we're here talking to a lot of people who are using SharePoint for intranets. That still remains the primary application that people are using SharePoint for. And people often, you know, I would say this is my third SPC. And 3 years ago when we were here at Anaheim, well, not here, we were in Anaheim, right? And in Anaheim, we were talking to people and they're like, huh, why would I measure my intranet? And now we look at some of the sessions. You know, I was in a session before lunch showing off these beautiful intranets that are really designed to look and feel like the types of websites that you use in your personal life every day. Right, so the intranet that is driving success for the organization today is not just a file repository, and it's not somewhere where you just go to try to find stuff that you're looking for through some convoluted navigational maze. It needs to be a website that's thought through with users in mind, with use cases in mind, with applications, and with success metrics in mind. So more and more today, we're talking to people who are using analytics for their intranets because they're trying to understand user adoption and engagement. And they're trying to improve those things so that they can deliver a better ROI to their organization. So getting Web Trends to work, pretty simple. We have a site collection feature, a couple of them actually, that can collect information from your site collections, simply activate or deactivate. What this does is it actually installs a Web Trends data collection JavaScript tag into the master page templates for the site collection. And it does that in an automated way, so you can toggle on, toggle off, simple implementation of the data collection methodology for SharePoint. An even easier approach that many people are using and which works for Office 365 is to simply add this one line of code to your master page templates in Office 365. Okay, so pretty straightforward implementation approach, and it provides a whole host of metrics about what's happening on your site. So this is a dashboard. I opted against the live demo here. I was at this conference a few years ago, and live demos were crashing all around me. So I decided, against that, and just have some of the screens here in PowerPoint. But this is a dashboard from Web Trends Analytics for the SharePoint conference. Now, what we're looking at here is January versus December. So I worked on these slides a few weeks back and was looking month over month. You can see the trend lines for total page views, visits, all these key metrics. And you can toggle just around any of those key metrics, and the graph will change to show you the month over month for the different points that you're looking at. The dips are the weekends. People, turns out, don't try to find out about SharePoint Conference on Saturday and Sunday. Did anyone go to this site on a Saturday? I mean, some people did. There's some traffic, but not a lot. So one thing that they learned was that Monday was actually the best day to be promoting the conference to people. They got their highest boost of traffic and their most conversions on Mondays and on Wednesdays. And Fridays, no go. Saturday, Sunday, forget about it. So that's just one interesting piece here. One of the things that they looked at are these heat maps. So the heat maps are ways to visually see at a glance where your traffic is going. And so this is just off the homepage here. You can see that most people in this, oh, I found out about this. This is cool. I could do this. Ah! All right, don't do that. Didn't you do this? There we go. Laser pointer. So right here, that's where most of the traffic was. So people were hitting this homepage and then, you know, going in a bit deeper for more information. Shouldn't have done that. There we go. So I looked at registrations. That's one of the metrics that I mentioned that we were paying attention to. And so, again, this is the one that shows Monday as being the best day for registrations. Wednesday, see, I get ahead of myself. Monday, Wednesday, and then it tails off toward the week, and the weekends were not very good for driving registrations. We tracked each of the registration funnels differently, the general registration, the exhibit hall only registration, crew, guests, and speakers, and we're looking at the registrations for each of those. Now, we also looked at the conversion funnel, because one of the things that is generally pretty interesting when you're looking at a multi-stage conversion process is understanding how people are navigating through that process. In this case here, the first step that had the most traffic was whenever you clicked anywhere on the site that said register, it took you to a page where you had some options to start the registration process. You know, what were you was it a general registration, speaker, what were you registering for? And so that was this first step here. And then we followed all the way through the process how customers got from step one through step eight, which is the acknowledgement of the registration being complete. We had one optional step in here, that's step five. That was the hotel booking. So most people were actually bypassing that step and going straight through. As you can see here, apart from the huge decline from people who hit the registration page to actually click in to start a registration process, that was one area that they looked at to see how can we improve that, how can we make sure that people know where to go and how to get, you know, how to start the registration process. And then the rest of the process they had looked pretty good. This first step here, let me try this again. So this step here, you'll notice this conversion rate here was only 58%. And so this was after you hit register now, and then you hit the next button, and you got to the page. You went through the login page, and then you got to the page that had you fill in all your information on one page, right? And so they actually only were getting 58% of the people who got to that page, making it through that step of the process. So the counsel that provided for Olaf was to take a look at that page and see how he could make some improvements and perhaps shorten what they did there to drive some improvement in that. I also mentioned campaigns. So they looked at conversions by campaign. This is an eye chart. I recognize that. But this shows all the different campaigns that they were running. And we have this sort of visual heat map of the data here. The darker ones are the ones where you've got the higher numbers. And so you can kind of at a glance go down to find out, you know, which ones have the highest bounce rate, that is, people who hit the site and leave without going any deeper than the page that they hit. Turns out the highest bounce rates were on the display ads that they were doing. So running display ads, people were clicking on it, hitting the website, and immediately leaving. So they deprioritized some of the banner ads that they were doing because they weren't really driving positive results. We looked at search engine traffic. And what was kind of interesting here, and the reason I bring it up, is Google, you know, is the number one search engine that people are using. Google's not very kind, and they actually now are blocking the search term. So you see that of the 21,000 Google searches, we couldn't tell what people were searching for 20,000 of them. Google blocks that for anyone who's now logged in while they're looking at Google. They block it from the URL. So we can't capture that information, but Bing's nicer. And so Bing, when we look at Bing, and even when we look at what was there for Google, most of the people that were finding the conference through any search engine were actually searching for the conference. There was some variation of a term of searching for the conference itself. Now, we talked about top sessions. I wish that the best sessions of search had been in place earlier, because we might have fared better on this. But we were looking at the top sessions. This is what Microsoft was looking at to understand what people were interested in. One thing jumped out at me here, the top session, update on InfoPath and SharePoint forms. I said, why is that driving so many people to the site? And I went back and saw this blog post that was actually driving people to the site. So Microsoft had blogged about this session here, and in the session they had this sentence of, come check it out at the SharePoint conference. And so people were clicking on this and landing on the session, and then they were actually registering for the conference. And so it ended up being the sixth most popular way that people got to the site of all the things that Microsoft was doing. So I talked to Olaf and suggested that they do more of this kind of blog post. The Clinton blog as well was one of the big spikes of traffic. So that they were actually getting the most people when they were engaging people they already know on topics that they thought they would be interested in, and getting them to the conference that way. We also looked at top speakers, some popular names here who I'm sure some of you know. We looked at this, and I looked for Robert, 96. There's a lot of speakers here, right? There's a lot of sessions. And so that's not bad for Robert. He's still smiling. And I said, what the hell? 193. So that's, you know, we could have done some manipulation and made that happen, but no, it's not how we do it. So anyway, those were some of the things that we looked at. One of the things that Olaf asked me to talk about was how accessible data is from Web Trends for external use. And so sharing and building dashboards is really easy using Web Trends and data in Web Trends. In fact, the Web Trends user experience is all built on top of our own APIs. So anything you can see in our own UX, you can get access to through the APIs. This is just one example of a web services API for pulling out data from a dashboard. If you can discern the code here, you'll see the kind of rolling date so that you can embed it within an Excel spreadsheet or within a dashboard, and every time you open it, it refreshes the data with a relative date range, so it's always kept up to date. And if you put it into an Excel spreadsheet, you just authenticate that once, and then the data comes over that way. So we are nearing the end, and we want to have some time left for questions. So just a few key takeaways here. You want to?
Well, just to wrap it up, I mentioned it before, but remember, external lists, not available as a catalog. Query rules, we spent a lot of time figuring this out, really. Don't try it. Take it from me. They don't work on the session overview in the speaker overview page, and they don't work with refiners.
Yeah, and then think about the metrics during the design stages so that you're thinking about those success metrics early on and making sure that you can build it to be measurable. So these were some other sessions. What did you want to say about this?
Nothing.
All right, there's other sessions.
I put them in.
There's other sessions, and then there's another page of other sessions.
Let's take some questions.
And let's take some questions.
All right.
Here, I'll run we're going to need this, so I'll run this around here.
You showed us the top speakers. Was that based on the evaluations, or how do we... How did you get the top speakers?
Top speakers was actually based on how when people were searching for speakers or when they were looking at individual speaker profiles on the website, the most viewed speakers. So each one of the speakers on the site had their own page with their bio and information about them as well.
Yeah, all the measurements you saw were pre-conference, so no data for that. Yeah. Oh, sorry. No, just ask a question and then we'll go.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
You mentioned intranets before. Do you provide some functionality in WebTrends for measuring social functionality, like people follow each other?
Yes.
And documents?
Yeah, from a social perspective, WebTrends was measuring the social capabilities in SharePoint 2013. And we are also in the process of building a Yammer analytics solution that will augment what we are doing for SharePoint. That's not yet available, but we have a partnership in place with Citrion as well. And so we capture information about how people are collaborating and look at things like how different departments are collaborating with each other and who's contributing to groups and who's contributing to discussions as well. It's kind of a way to foster some of your power users.
Jeff, I think the lady over there had a question. You still have a question?
Yes.
Does WebTrends somehow integrate or use the built-in SharePoint central administration reports, site usage and things like that? Site visits and...
Yeah, actually, we don't use those at all. So everything WebTrends does is independent of what you can get out of SharePoint in terms of the analytics there. And we don't actually tap into any of the data within SharePoint. Everything we collect from the client at the page level using the JavaScript collection tag that I mentioned. I see a question back here.
So you had mentioned one of the big things you were looking for to measure was the registrations, and you showed Mondays were the highest traffic to the site. Did you in turn look at if registrations then in turn were up on Mondays percentage-wise compared to the other days? Is that how you broke it down?
Well, on an absolute number of registrations, we got the highest numbers on Mondays. And so as a percentage of, I don't know if we looked at that specifically, but just looking at the absolute registration numbers each week, they peaked on Monday, had a little spike midweek, and then kind of fell down toward the weekend.
Okay.
And one of the charts that you saw up there, we normalize everything when you're looking at it to the week, so that the weekends you can kind of see how your days stack up against each other, which is valuable for many types of businesses that want to see how popular different days of the week are for different types of marketing programs.
Gotcha. All right, Jeff. Yeah. Time for one more? Oh, two more.
Thank you. One of the questions that we have been requested by our users is try to consolidate some statistics from different sites. We have cases where some kind of site collections have something commonality, right? So they want to aggregate so they can produce recurring reports. We are using Cardiolog, and it doesn't provide the functionality. That WebTrends, that capacity?
Yes. The question about site collection level. So while you can implement the collection tags at a site collection level, that's not necessarily how the reporting structured. So in the data collection tags themselves, we have a data collection ID. And if you use the same ID across multiple site collections, which is generally what people will do, they'll use the same ID to collect all of their data. And then the reports themselves, they will determine which piece of the entire infrastructure they want to see at a time. So they'll, for each individual site or for different portions of the overall farm. So happy to talk to you more afterwards.
There was one last question.
And there was one more question here.
Gentleman in front.
The question is related to, you know, your one of the slide on the, you know, the server topology and the infrastructure. That also relates to, you know, we had some Yammer discussion going on a few days back that performance was, you know, it was very slow because, you know, as we reach to the, you know, the event date, many people trying to log in, and then I see, you know, that issue, you know, it was much better. So have you had any plan for that? And
SPC you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
For all clarity, my SPC is not SharePoint.
Okay, it's not part
running. On any of the things I was talking about today. No SharePoint.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought
it not was us. Awesome. Sorry.
That's okay.
Cannot answer that question.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
All right. We're out of time.
We're all set. Remember to fill out your evaluations. And thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Good conference.
If you didn't get a book and you want a book, come by the Web Trends booth on the Expo Hall show floor.